Okay, good morning, everybody. Good morning, good morning. The date today is Saturday. It's July 20th. It's about 10 a.m. here on the West Coast. And I'm so glad to see all your faces and at least all your names here. We have new information to share with you about especially about overseas travel. So the information is relatively new to me, and there might be somebody here on call that knows more about this than I do. So if you do, prepare to speak. And I'm talking about the ETIAS system, which stands for European Travel Information Authorization System. And the reason bringing it up is in the past, we've always said there are 26 nations in Europe that will welcome you. That may not be long, that may not be in existence for very much longer. So I'm afraid to report. So we'll talk about that, what we know at this point in time. And again, there may be some people in the meeting today who know more than I do about it, but we do have a great article on the Axel website about it too. Okay, so again, welcome. My name is Janice Bellucci. I am the Executive Director of the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws, and this is our month meeting. And Ellie Miller is here. She is a criminal defense attorney and now a law professor at Loyola. And as I mentioned, she's also an Axel board member. So I am expecting one more Axel board member to join us, who, oh, by the way, happens to be a lawyer too. And I'll announce him if and when he goes up. Okay, so usually we talk about scams and we talk about compliance checks. I'm going to skip that this time because I'm tired of talking about it. And if you want to know about it, hopefully you'll go back and listen to one of the other meetings, because we do have some really new information to share here about overseas travel. So it is the season, and maybe I'm focused on this more than I would normally because I'm about to leave myself and I'm going to go overseas to Europe. Actually, 60 days or so. But I think it's important for anybody who's considering travel outside the country. For a very long time, Axel has encouraged people. It's like, when I get the calls, oh my gosh, there's nowhere that I can go. I need a break. I need a change of scenery. Where can I go? And we have strongly recommended that people go to Europe and that there are 26 countries within a coalition called Schengen. And in the past, the Schengen nations, all 26 of them, have welcomed people on the registry. Okay. And so they look at even the people who have the unique identifier on their passport. I swear they must just look at that and start laughing. And it's like, oh, those crazy Americans don't know what they're doing. It's amazing that they procreate. Okay. So things are changing. I just want you to know things are changing and perhaps not for the better. So there's a great article on the Axel website. I hope that you all will go and read it. And not only that, but there's all kinds of links. So what I did this morning prior to this meeting is I just kept clicking on links until I got information until I really could absorb any more information. But here's what's going on. Supposedly in early 2025, so we're talking about perhaps 6 months from now, the Europe, 26 countries in Europe, it's going to be more difficult to go visit them if you fall into one of their categories. So let me read the broad categories. People who are convicted of terrorism, sexual exploitation of children, trafficking of human beings, trafficking of drugs, murder, and rape. Supposedly people that fit in those categories, if it's happened within the past 10 years, this is according to their government website, you are, quote, likely to be declined entry into their countries. Okay. So again, the categories are terrorism, sexual exploitation of children, trafficking of human beings, trafficking of drugs, murder, and rape. So I'm sure it's a lawyer in me that makes me start questioning what do these things mean. I think the broadest category here, and heaven only knows what it means, is sexual exploitation of children. I don't know what that means. Maybe you know what that means, but that's one of those things. I hope that they will provide a lot more details about that. And one of the things it says too, okay, if you've been convicted of one of those crimes within the past 10 years, you are, quote, likely likely to be declined. Okay, but then it says, well, what if it's been more than 10 years, right? What if it's been 25 years? Does that mean you have a green light? I don't know. Does the fact that you're still required to register make a difference? And I don't know that answer either. Part of the process for doing this, by the way, you do it all online, right? And so it says right here, and I read to you briefly, it says to apply for an ETIAS, you complete a short online form answering details such as name and address, as well as passport details. Here goes security questions and medical history. But I don't know, a passport doesn't require medical history, so this is interesting. Then it says it usually takes around 10 to 20 minutes to complete the form, and you need to have your passport details with you when you complete it. I'm sure because they're going to ask you for your passport number. But get this, it says once you submit the form, and you're doing this online and pay an application fee, and I never could find out what the fee was. It was supposed to be a low fee, maybe $20, $25. Your application will usually be processed, quote, very quickly. Whatever that means, right? And then if it is approved, this is really interesting. It will be electronically linked to your passport. Electronically linked to your passport. So you don't have to take your passport anywhere. You don't have to go in person anywhere. But supposedly, you can give them this information online, and supposedly, somehow, they can basically grant you entrance or not. And it's all going to happen electronically. So it's a good thing I'm not a conspiracy theorist. But anyway, I'm bringing this up because this is a significant change, folks. And by the way, they've been talking about ETIAS for years. And in fact, when I go on here and click these links, one of the things that it keeps saying is, it keeps saying is, oh, well, it's going to be effective in this year or that year or the other year. The most recent thing that I saw was it said it would become effective in, quote, early 2025, which is early next year. So I think we have to let this, I was going to call it rose bloom, but I don't think it's a rose. Let's call it a dandelion. Let this dandelion bloom, and we're going to have to watch it and see how far it spreads. But I am concerned that many people are now who are required to register or who have ever been convicted of these offenses are no longer going to be allowed to enter Europe. So I'm giving you this initial information as an alert, not a reason to panic. However, comma, if you can get to Europe in 2024, I don't think you have to worry about this. So that's not a recommendation. It's just do what you're going to do. But to be on alert that it looks like there are going to be some significant changes in who gets into Europe, into these European countries, and how you might be treated. And again, I'm not sure if I'm happy or unhappy, and you all can make your own decision, of course, about whether or not is a good thing to be able to apply for this online, right? For them to make a decision, quote, online. And then if they in fact authorize your travel to these European countries, it's going to happen electronically on your passport. Like, how does that happen? So somebody online today right now who knows or at least has a theory about that. But look, before I move on to another topic, how about does anybody else have any hints here, either about what this ETIAS system or overseas travel? Because I don't plan to go come back to it. You can put up your hand like that, or you can use the button down at the bottom or not. Okay. All right. So again, it's an alert that something is changing over in Europe, supposedly in early 2025, that might exclude some people from traveling there. Again, it does say 10 years. So after 10 years, I've heard in Europe there's a right to be forgotten. So I'm glad they're honoring it here and stuff, but I'm concerned about their definitions or maybe lack of terms like sexual exploitation of children. And quite frankly, the one thing that comes to mind right away is whether or not that would apply to somebody who's convicted of possessing child pornography, which probably is legal in their country, by the way. So Dan, I see that you have your hand up. Do you have a question, sir, or a comment? Dan, there you go.
Does this apply to non-Schengen European countries such as Great Britain and the like? In other
That's a
words,
good.
are they going to be a part of the system?
Is England going to be part of the system? Brian is shaking
Yes.
his head, is shaking his head yes. I don't know if that means he thinks so or he knows so, but I do see. I and remember, this is just an alert, so I am not an expert in this. This is like almost brand new information to me. We only added it to the website, I think, yesterday. And so this morning before this meeting started, I made sure that I went and read the article and I clicked on some of the the links and stuff. I saw there were like two lists of countries, and that England, I think England is part of the European Union, but I don't know that they're part of the ETIAS system. I'm sorry, I don't know that. So maybe what Dan is getting to is maybe there's some good news here too. Maybe people who have been convicted of a sex offense may in fact be allowed to enter England and some other countries that haven't been in the past. I don't know the answer to that question, but we will post more information about this system, ETIAS, on the Axel website as it comes available and as people start to understand it. I'm not sure why it's taken so long, quite frankly, for Europe to develop this system. But I've been watching for several years and I haven't taken it very seriously until now because it seems to me up to this point in time, they themselves, the Europeans, kept changing it or saying or postponing it, I guess is more accurate. Okay. So I don't see any other hands up or anything. We do have a guest visitor today, Bill. And Bill, if you would unmute yourself. Bill is part of a really important organization called COSA. I don't know if it's really an organization or movement, but it's a really important thing that's going on where people who have been convicted of a sex offense, basically, in some situations, but not all, Bill, please correct me if I'm wrong, that people convicted of a sex offense sometimes get together with a victim, if not their victim, and basically discuss the ramifications of what was done. So, Bill, why don't you take it from there if you would?
Okay. Yes. Yeah. I've been a part of COSA ever since I got out of prison 14 years ago. And basically what COSA does, it stands for Circles of Support and Accountability. And they help a registrant integrate back into society by finding them, first of all, a place to live, then helping them find a job, get integrated, hopefully into a church, and get right back in as quick as they can. They're part of a circle initially with a 1 year commitment to meet once a week with four or five community members that also make up that circle. And so that's where the name COSA comes from, Circles of Support and Accountability. And the accountability is as big a part of it as the support is. You know, both of those are included. Occasionally, but not very often, do they encourage the victim and the perpetrator to get together. That has happened a couple of dozen times, but mostly it's integrating back into society. And after I did my 1 year, and it was very helpful to me getting integrated back in, especially with my place of employment. I was a professor at Fresno Pacific University, and initially I was barred from campus forever. Thanks to COSA, they set up a restoration committee with faculty members from the university and members of my circle, and we worked things out, and I'm now teaching there again, teaching teachers. So these are all people who are you know, over the age of 21. They all are teachers, and so I've got a job back in the university, and I'm welcome there again. But COSA is a wonderful organization. I'm a volunteer now in four circles. One of them is what's called the community circle, where anybody who's ever been either a core member or a volunteer, or they're just interested in it, can meet at the Mennonite Willow Avenue Church in Fresno. And that's every Friday afternoon. I was there yesterday. We had a little over a dozen 290s or registrants were there. And we just talk together. We can be honest with each other. There's no judgment there. And it's just been very helpful. I know a no number of people have found out about Janice and the possibility of even getting their tier assignment changed, maybe getting off of the registry even. And so it's a COSA is a very helpful thing for registrants, especially when they first get out, and then it continues. Some of the circles I've been a part of, I'm still good friends with a core member. I had lunch on Friday with a former core member. His circle started over 10 years ago, and we're still friends and still get together. So it's a great organization. question.
Well, thank you, Bill. Joe has a hand up. Joe, are you applauding Bill, or do you have a question or a comment? Joe, okay. Sorry, I'm answering a thing there. Okay, so Joe, do you want to speak? If you do, shake your head yes. If you don't, that's okay. All right. So, Bill, thank you very much for sharing that. I will tell you, I've been somewhat familiar about COSA for a long time, but I have to admit I wasn't up to date in my information. And I'm just going to invite you right here in a recording before all these people to join us at our conference this year as a speaker. So I've sent you a direct chat. If you take a look at that, and then maybe we can connect next week. That would be great.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so we do have a lot more things. Folks, you just never know what's going to happen in these meetings, do you? So I didn't know that Bill was going to join us today, and it was a really good idea, Bill, for you to wear that t-shirt, let me tell you. Okay, so before I go on, let me talk a little bit about domestic travel, because 'tis the season to travel for a lot of people traveling during the summertime. And most of all, I would like you to know that I am very, that it's okay to travel domestically, but it is a good idea to plan your travel, your domestic travel. And the reason that I'm saying this is each and every state has different requirements for registering. Okay. And so it can trigger your just visiting another state can actually trigger a requirement to register. And guess what? If you're required to register and you don't register, it's quite possible that you too will be charged with and convicted of a failure to register, which in some states is a felony. Okay. So folks, this is really, really important that you avoid registering in or in any more states than you need to, or maybe put a little more directly that you register in as few states as possible. And the reason for this, really, a lot of it has to do with the International Megan's Law. Okay, so I hope you all know there's something called the International Megan's Law. Okay, International Megan's Law applies to everyone who was convicted of a sex offense involving a minor, and that's factor number one, and factor number two, and is currently required to register in any state. Okay, so if you're registered in multiple states, guess what? The fact that you get off one state's registry doesn't help you. The International Megan's Law still applies to you, and International Megan's Law that ultimate penalty for violating that federal law, because it is a federal law, is up to 10 years in federal prison. And I don't know about you, but I don't want to spend 10 years in federal prison, okay? And so it's a very serious thing that you're dealing with. And there's two components of the International Megan's Law if it applies to you. Number one, you have to give 21-day notice to local law enforcement, not the federal government, but to local law enforcement, to the office where you register. You have to give them notice at least 21 days before you leave the country. Okay. Number two, you have to have a unique identifier added to your passport at some point in time. I hate the unique identifier on the passport. It is a scarlet letter. Maybe it's worse than the scarlet letter, because it does remind me, quite frankly, of what Nazi Germany did to Jews back in the day, right? And so literally what they did, Nazi Germany, on the passports of their Jewish citizens, they put a very large red J. And everybody knew what that meant. That meant that you were Jewish. And in the beginning, it was just slowed down travel. And at the end, it basically prevented you from traveling outside the country. So it is what it is, folks. We've tried to challenge the International Megan's Law one. It was a belly flop. I was the attorney. We had a terrible judge. I wanted to appeal it. And we went to an expert who said, if you appeal it, you're going to lose, 70% chance of losing. So with those odds, we didn't go forward and appeal it, because it's bad enough to have a federal district court judge who said, oh, yeah, it's fine to have a scarlet letter on your passport. But we didn't want the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals making that decision as well. So Eric has his hand up. Eric, go ahead and unmute yourself. And if you have a question or comment, this is the time.
Hi, Janice. I do have a question.
Okay, cool.
A number of guys that I'm on parole, been out 7 months now after 31 years in prison for two sexual assaults I committed when I was 23 and 25. So I'm out now, and I'm scared to death to go to an apartment complex and try to rent an apartment. Should I be? Will they reject me? Will they refuse me? Are they allowed to?
Eric, do you know if you're considered a high-risk offender?
You mean my
your static 99 score. If you have a static 99 score of 4 or above, you're considered high risk. And
I don't
bring
have
this.
That.
Okay, good. Because, and for people who are here today, but people also listening to the recording at a later time, if you're a high risk offender, and that means static 99 score 4 or higher, then you cannot live within half a mile of a school. Okay. And that's a K through 12 school. Okay. If you don't have that concern, then that's one less thing you need to worry about. Landlords are not supposed to discriminate against a person solely because they're on the registry. However, there's a state law that says that. However, there's also an exception to that state law, which says except to protect a person at risk. All right. And unfortunately, the courts in California have interpreted that exception very broadly. And so, yes, they can. And some of them do deny you housing because you're on the registry. So that's not everybody. Based upon the comments I've heard over the years, people have greater success when they go to a small apartment complex, maybe even a duplex, okay, as compared to going to one of these mega apartment complexes. And the reason is the mega apartment complexes, they usually do a more thorough background check, okay? And another possibility is if you rent a single family home, I don't know if you can afford that or not, but they're, you know, more likely to rent to you, believe it or not, if it's a single family home. So I hope I've answered your question, Eric.
Yeah, I was hoping. You said there's a law. Can you tell me that law? Do you know it off the top? Is it a penal code section in California?
Here we go. Ready?
Yeah, I very much am.
All right. Penal code section 290.46, subsection J. Okay. Thou shalt not. These are Moses' tablets, right? Thou shalt not discriminate against somebody solely because they're on the registry for the following purposes. And housing is one of those. Okay. But there is an exception. And by the way, so is employment. So is employment. So is credit. It's a long list. So is doing business in the state of California.
Yeah. Folks, I actually asked my parole agent if he wouldn't mind calling the apartment complex and asking them, would it be all right? Because he's approved the apartment complex.
Okay.
And I asked if he would call the apartment complex and ask them, would they have a problem with me coming in and living there and signing a lease and all that. And he says, that's not something we do. And I said, well, I'd hate to go in the office and try to get legit, because I'm staying at the complex already, but I'd hate to go in there and I want to get on the lease and be legit, but you know, he wouldn't do it. So I'd hate to go in there and have them draw attention to myself and have them say, get the hell out of here.
Well, I understand, Eric, that housing can be challenging for somebody on the registry, and I'm happy to talk to you about it offline. But just in general, again, based upon the 12 plus years I've been working on this, it seems that people have the best luck if they go to a smaller complex, and if you want your name on the lease is what I'm hearing, because they don't necessarily do credit checks. They don't necessarily do as in-depth background as others. Okay. So
thanks so much, Janice. Thank you.
Okay. And folks, I see people asking some really specific questions in the chat about their circumstances. I'm running the board here. I'm speaking. The chance of me answering your question is very small in the chat room. So please don't ask me a specific question in the chat room. Okay. I will type in my contact information and you can certainly contact me next week, but I can't, I'm a pretty good multitasker, but I can't pull that one off. Thank you for understanding. Okay, so back to domestic travel. Again, I encourage you, get out of the house. Go see the sites. It's the easiest thing to do, usually, is stay in the same state where you live. In California, we have a very diverse state. We have mountains, we have beaches, we have, you know, everything in between. So there is a lot of diversity in this state. But on the other hand, I know that there are beautiful places outside the state of California as well. And so I'm not trying to discourage you from going to visit them, but I'm telling you to plan your trip. And I really, my blood runs cold when somebody calls me up and says, oh, I rented an RV or bought an RV and I want to travel across the country. Do I have anything to worry about? Yeah, the answer is yes, you do. Okay. So please, please, please plan ahead. It's not, you can do that successfully, but if you if you don't plan ahead, you too could end up convicted of a felony and go to prison. So it's up to you how much risk you want to take in these matters, because, you know, maybe you can go visit a state and you overstay your visit and you're supposed to register and you don't get caught. Okay. Maybe people run red lights too, and they don't get caught. But the fact is, some people do get caught. And that's why I'm just alerting you to the risk of it. And then you can make your own decision about it. So, Ryan, I'm going to ask you if you want to talk about this. I'm sorry, not Ryan. It's Bob. Bob, yes. Do you want to talk? You've had some experience with this.
I don't really know where to start. Janice was wonderful enough to petition the court in California, and I am now no longer required to register in California. However, I have lived in Arizona for the last 19 years, and the law just changed here so that I'm a level one sex offender from 23 years ago, and Arizona just changed there was an amendment to Senate bill that changed the law so that level one sex offenders are now going to be fired. So there will be, I'm now going to be subject to notification through mailings to the neighborhood with my picture and offenses and things like that. So because of that, we've decided to move back to California, where I'm no longer required to register. And luckily, we found that when moving out of Arizona, I am physically removed from the registry. And so moving back to California will make it so that hopefully I can have my passport cleared, because I am subject to the, I did have my passport revoked about a year ago, subject to the international Megan's Law. So that's kind of my situation right now. But I'm still nervous, even moving back to California, traveling to another state. So much research has to be done before you do that, as Janice said, because you don't know how subject you are to the laws of that state, even though I am no longer required to register in California, and I will have moved from Arizona, but I'm still subject to register in other states depending on their laws.
Thank you, Bob, for sharing that. Mm-hmm. So folks, I've now represented 105 people who no longer are required to register in the state of California. Having said that does not mean they don't have to register when they visit another state, okay? And so that's why I'm telling you that planning a trip, a domestic trip, is really important to plan, because there's a list of states that there's some states that basically say if you've ever been required to register, if you've ever been convicted of a sex offense, you have to register if you go visit their state. There are other states that say the opposite. And then there's a whole bunch of states in between. So we do have somebody who's working on some research right now. Hopefully, I've asked him, because he's a volunteer, I have asked him to complete his research before our conference in September so that we can share that information with you at the conference. And then, of course, you'll have that information to refer to even after the conference. So it's a sticky wicket out there, folks. And again, you know, you can decide for yourself, how much risk are you willing to take? And so let's talk about visiting Las Vegas. The state of Nevada says, if you're visiting the state of Nevada, then if you stay more than 48 hours, you must register. So I've had people call me up and go, well, I've stayed in Las Vegas for a week and I've not had a problem. And my response is, good for you at one time, but that doesn't guarantee you can stay there and not get caught the next time. So you have to decide for yourself how much risk you want to take, you know, and I mean, we all take risk in life, right? Especially if we get in our cars, that's a risk, right? If we drive down the block, it's a risk. So how much risk are you willing to assume? And, you know, the thing is, if you run a red light, you're not going to be put in federal prison for 10 years. I mean, think about it too, risk versus penalty. But on the other hand, you know, that could happen if you violate the International Megan's Law. So I don't tell people things to scare you at all. I just want to help you safely navigate, or at least more safely navigate through what really is like a minefield out there, especially when it comes to domestic travel. So does anybody have any questions or comments before we leave domestic travel, that area? Okay.
Janice, I have a comment. I had a client who was living in California and decided that he wanted to see if he could live in Arkansas. And I truly believe the reason he was stopped in Arkansas, because he had out-of-state plates, California plates. And they found out he was a 290 individual, he decided to return to California because it would cost him $400 to register in Arkansas as a registrant, and he didn't have the money. And it turned into a big mess because he was living in Alameda County, and there was an extradition warrant several times, and Arkansas took their good old time before they got him back, and it was a big mess. But I believe it was the California plate that sparked the curiosity for the officer to stop his vehicle. So be careful if you're driving a car out of state with California plates.
I'm sure you're a person of interest in a state like Arkansas. Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Ellie, for sharing that. And again, you know, Ellie and I are sharing information with you. We're hoping that you can avoid basically law enforcement involvement, can we call it, these days. Basically keep you out of jail and out of prison. That's really the bottom line. Okay. So let's go ahead and go on. I'm going to talk about something today that I don't talk about on a regular basis, but it's been brought up a couple times recently. It has to do with Section 8 housing. So Section 8 housing is housing in which the federal government provides a financial subsidy of one sort or another. And I say that because sometimes you don't know that it's the federal government. You know, you might say there's a state agency, or it might even look like a nonprofit organization or something like that that has the housing. But the fact is, if they receive money from the federal government under Section 8, then this following rule applies, which is if you are required to register for life, okay, register for life, then you're not eligible to either live in or certainly obtain Section 8 housing. So think about that. If you're required to register for life. So most states now have tiered registries. At least in those states, there's at least the possibility that you're not required to register for life. So California, if you're assigned to either tier 1 or tier 2, then you're not required to register for life. Now, that doesn't mean necessarily that your petition will ever be granted, but at least you're eligible to petition, right? And so, I mean, that alone then turns around and makes you eligible to live in Section 8 housing and possibly even to obtain Section 8 housing on your own. And some, I think more and more providers of Section 8 housing are waking up to this and realizing that, again, not everybody who's required to register is required to register for life. And so more and more people are getting Section 8 housing. But I want to let you know that if you're having a problem with Section 8 housing, contact me. I have written memos on behalf of many people, many individuals, basically explaining to the Section 8 housing provider that they'll fit in the situation, and specifically saying, you know, John Doe is no longer required to register for life. He's only, you know, after 20 years or whatever it is going to be eligible to petition for removal. And therefore, you know, he is now eligible is now eligible for Section 8 housing. And, you know, while it might seem a no-brainer, for some people, and I'm talking about the providers of the Section 8 housing, for some reason, it seems hard for them to grasp that. Or maybe they just need a lawyer to tell them it's okay. I'm not sure which. But again, I'm available to do that for you, and certainly at no cost whatsoever. I'm happy to do it for people who really do need Section 8 housing and might have been denied Section 8 housing past. Are there any questions about Section 8 housing before we move on? I'm going to change screens here to look. Okay. All right. Well, before I go on to the next substantive topic, let me tell you, Eric's hand is up. Eric, I'll call on you just a minute. I hope you all know that Axel has a conference in September of this year. So about 2 months from now, on September 20th, which is a Friday, and September 21st, which is a Saturday, we will have a conference. Okay. This conference is going to be virtual. So we're experimenting to see how this works and how it affects attendance. So we have people outside the state who've asked us many times to have a virtual conference. Just think about it, like this meeting. We have over 60 people in this meeting today, and none of you had to drive anywhere, including me. And that's a good thing, right? We're helping the environment. We're improving our lives. We're taking less time. So the conference is going to be virtual this year. You will still need to sign up for the conference. There's a very low fee if you want to join. We do have some administrative costs that are related to this. Another benefit, quite frankly, is we have speakers from all over the United States, and guess what? They don't have to travel to the conference either. So I will miss seeing you all in person. I do enjoy having the conference in person for that reason. But again, this year we're going to have a virtual conference. So September 20 and September 21 are the dates. And Eric, go ahead and unmute yourself.
So for veterans, speaking of Section 8 housing,
yes.
Are you familiar with HUD-VASH?
No, not specifically.
HUD-VASH is HUD, Veterans Assisted Service, something to do with veterans. But
okay.
just like in Section 8, they too, military veterans are also excluded from participating in HUD-VASH vouchers. And, you know, it's a rent payment. It facilitates rent payment for low income and for veterans. And if you haven't heard of it, you probably haven't done any litigation or research in that field, but it's kind of the same thing. And it's an area, though, that because of the veteran status could afford, could probably give more leeway than the HUD itself, Section 8. I just throw that out there because I was talking with, I don't know if, well, he's a guy that runs a program in California called Veterans Healing Veterans, Ron Self, and he is on a commission for the federal government with Senator Panetta for veterans. And he's actually getting the senator to consider advocating for veterans to be afforded the VASH housing that's kind of like Section 8. But anyway, since you haven't done the actual anything on it, but it is an area for those of the members of AXSOL or participants who are vets to look into.
Well, yeah, thank you, Eric, for that information. I am a veteran myself. I served in the Navy for 8 years. But I've never been personally involved in that program. I am somewhat aware of a program. I just didn't know it by that acronym. And I did talk to somebody who I think is in Long Beach and she works for the VA. But veterans there's no special consideration for somebody if you're a veteran under Section 8. So the Section 8 rule applies. If you are on a lifetime registry, then you are you're not eligible for Section 8 housing, whether you're a veteran or you're not a veteran. Okay. I think it's wrong, but that's what the law says. We have not ever challenged that law. I think the better way to help veterans and a program like that is in fact through legislation rather than through litigation. I don't think we would be successful in litigation because what would the judge say? I'm just interpreting the law as it's written. Okay. So what then needs to happen here is that the law needs to be changed. Okay. All right. So let's move on. I'm glad that we talked about that today and I'm sincere in my offer. By the way, I put my name and contact information in the chat room. And again, it's impossible for me to answer your questions in the chat room. So contact me next week. I'd be happy to talk to you then. I want to talk about two lawsuits that we have filed outside the state of California and talk to you about the possible two more lawsuits that we might file outside of California. Okay, number one is Missouri. So Vicki Henry, it's good to see you from Missouri. And she knows about this because she was at the trial. So she attended the trial. We filed a federal lawsuit in the state of Missouri, basically challenging a state law that requires every registrant to post a sign somewhere in their home on Halloween. And believe me, the specifics of that law were discussed in great detail in the trial. And so the trial is over. That trial was supposed to be a 2-day trial. The judge rushed us through it and became a 1-day trial. So for whatever reason, his honor thought that was important to have a 1-day trial. It happened. Okay. And so our final trial briefs were due yesterday. We filed our final trial brief. I don't think the general filed his brief. Not sure why. But we'll find out. Usually they file really lengthy briefs. This is what I'm expecting to happen in that case. I'm expecting this judge to grant this is big news, a permanent statewide injunction. A permanent statewide injunction, which would prohibit every law enforcement official in the state of Missouri from enforcing the Halloween sign requirement. This would be big, big news.
Love you, Janice.
I thank you. So judges do not like to do this, by the way. This judge has a backbone and he's been very consistent in letting everybody know in the litigation that he thinks that this Halloween sign requirement violates the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. That is our legal argument. All right. So that's one heck of an argument to be made. And by the way, one of the reasons we lawyers like First Amendment cases is the other side has a really high burden. Okay. Their burden is it's called strict scrutiny. That's the standard of review, which is the highest standard of review. So the attorney general in this case had to prove that this law was not overbroad. It was narrowly tailored and all these other things. And they did not prove that. I mean, I can just tell you, they didn't prove it. And the judge told them they didn't prove it. Okay. Because get this, part of their argument, this is the attorney general's argument. Part of the argument was, well, the law doesn't say how big the sign has to be. The sign could be a post-it note. Okay. The sign could be put up in the tent, you know, the upper corner of the door. Okay. So how is that supposed to protect anybody, right? If the sign is so darn important, then how can a sign on a post-it note that you put up in the upper right-hand corner of your door, how is that effective? And not only that, but the judge went on. The judge, it was interesting. He was basically testifying himself. And he goes, and the sign could be inside the house too. Is that right? And still comply with this law. And they had to admit, yes, that was true. So then I was like, what the heck? This law makes absolutely no sense. So, you know, I'm expecting a very positive result here from the federal district court judge. And then I expect the attorney general to appeal this. Okay. The attorney general, I mean, we tried to settle this case so many times, and the attorney general kept saying no, no, no. Finally, the AG said the following. Look, folks, this is a statewide injunction. That was just when it was a temporary restraining order, right? If it becomes a permanent statewide injunction, the attorney general is going to fight like bloody hell. So, and it's going to be a fast fight, because if you look at the calendar, guess what? Halloween's only 3 months away. So the Eighth Circuit and trying to get a decision out of a circuit, in that amount of time, we'll see. So just a little background information. When the judge issued the temporary restraining order in this case, the attorney general, and they did it on a Friday afternoon, the attorney general within hours filed an emergency stay with the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, asking the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals to stop the temporary restraining order. Guess what their Eighth Circuit said? No. I love that decision, by the way. I really need to frame it and hang it in my office, because it was such a precise, concise statement that was made by the Eighth Circuit, because it was only two sentences long. This Eighth Circuit's decision. When again, the attorney general is coming in right on a horse with a cavalry, and it was like, oh, with lots of guns and stuff, and going, oh yeah, this is terrible. You need to stop this, Eighth Circuit. And by the way, whenever the AG's office files any brief, it's always like 50% longer than it's supposed to be. Believe it or not, we have rules in courts even about how long our briefs can be, especially in federal courts. So anyway, the Eighth Circuit's decision was only two sentences long. One sentence was, you want to file a brief that's too long to the AG? Okay, that's fine. Sentence number two, oh, by the way, your motion is denied. That is a really concise decision, two sentences long. I've never seen one so short. So anyway, but you know, the fact is, thank you for the heart there, David. The fact is, it looks like we're going to go back to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. I think I have hope and pray that Attorney General doesn't wait till the very last minute, because, oh my goodness, you know, after they filed their emergency motion or their for stay last fall, you know, my legal assistant and I got very little sleep for 3 days, because we had to respond in basically 2.5 days. And we did. And as I said, we were successful. But anyway, the good news is there was no Halloween sign requirement in the year 2023. Hopefully there will be no Halloween sign requirement in the year 2024. Okay. And folks, we're not doing, this is not a game, right? What we understand is if you have to put a sign on your door on Halloween or any other darn time, right, your neighbors then know that you're on the registry. Now, is that information available to them? Yes. I mean, they can go on your state Megansaw website. They can go on the nsopw.gov. That's a federal website, and find out if, in fact, somebody on the registry lives close to them. They can find out this information. But you know what? It requires effort, and most people don't bother to look people up who are on the registry. And that's a good thing, right? But there are some people who do. So anyway, there's no reason to out yourself as a person required to register to your neighbors by putting a sign sign on your door. Now, this is the state of Missouri, and the sign requirement was for one day. We're talking about only 24 hours. So that lawsuit, I told you where it is right now and what we expect to happen in the near future. Let's talk about the state just south of there, and that is the state of Arkansas. So in the state of Arkansas, they were requiring people to post a sign on their front door. By the way, it's not a post-it note. It's a sign that law enforcement created and printed up, okay? And they were requiring that people on the registry put those signs on their front door for 2 weeks. Not 24 hours, but 2 weeks. When we found out about this, we just got hopping mad. It's like, I don't think so. And when I saw that sign, I'm like, oh my gosh. I mean, red letters and everything, right? Nobody's going to miss this sign. And oh, by the way, they put it on your door. So they're not going to put it in an upper right-hand corner of the door, right? They put it right in the middle of the freaking door. And it was really interesting. We only had, after the case was filed, we only had one meeting with the judge. And it was a very interesting meeting because it's a county in Arkansas. It's not a state law. By the way, there is no state law that requires a Halloween sign in Arkansas. There's no state law. So guess what? We found out through the discovery process, a bunch of sheriffs got together and either they were drinking moonshine or beer or I don't know, something, or smoking something. But the fact is they all decided that this was going to be a good idea. These sheriffs did, that they were going to start requiring Halloween signs. And so somebody went to the trouble and expense of getting these Halloween signs printed, right? Because remember, they're bringing the signs to the registrant's home and the registration officers are putting it on the front door. Okay, so here we are. We have this hearing with the judge, just like this. It's like a Zoom hearing. Unfortunately, I didn't have to go to Arkansas. Marion County, Arkansas was arguing that it was voluntary, that the registrant said, oh, it's okay, go ahead and put that sign on my door, right? And so the judge says, let me get this straight. So a man shows up, a deputy sheriff shows up, and he's got a gun on his belt, and this is voluntary? I mean, the judge actually said that. And so the other attorney was sputtering and was like, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, the judge didn't buy it at all. And guess what? That case has already been settled. Right? And so everybody signed the settlement agreement this week. So it is done. And at least in Marion County, Arkansas, there will not be a Halloween sign requirement. We only had a plaintiff in that county. I know that the county next to them, the county east of them, called Faulkner, as in the author, William Faulkner, that in fact, Faulkner County does require the sign, has the sign requirement as well. So if anybody knows anybody living in Faulkner County, please pass this information on. And if a lawsuit, you know, a new lawsuit needs to be filed, then fine, we'll do it. So, okay. So those are the two out-of-state lawsuits that have been filed so far, Missouri and Arkansas. These are the two we're looking at. We're looking at Texas. Actually, there's three. We're looking at Texas because in Texas, there are some cities down in the Rio Grande Valley, which is the very southern tip of Texas. I know I used to live there as a kid. I can't even believe I'm talking about the Rio Grande Valley, but I am. So anyway, there's some towns down there that decided recently that it would be a good idea to have a Halloween sign requirements. I guess they don't read our website or something. So, oh well. So we're looking for plaintiffs down there. There's one town in particular called Mission, Texas. If anybody knows somebody living in Mission, Texas, please get them my name and contact information. And by the way, there is a woman who's executive director of Texas Voices who also is helping look for somebody who might be affected, by this ordinance. It's a town ordinance. It's not a state law there in Texas. Okay, we're also looking at, believe it or not, Florida. So we weighed in and helped Florida this week. I see Chris is from Florida is online right now. So we helped Florida by drafting a letter to a city. The city is called Westlake, and the city was proposed to extend the residency restrictions from 1,000 feet to 2,500 feet. Okay, they did pass it, by the way, despite our well-written letter. the question is whether or not we want to litigate that or litigate some other things in Texas. So that's under consideration by our board of directors. And then another one has to do with the state of Oklahoma. So in the state of Oklahoma, and I met a man there because he came running up to me and said, Janice, we need some help in Oklahoma. And so the fact is, in Oklahoma, on their driver's license in big red letters, it says sex offender on the driver's license. So there have been some successful cases challenging that, and there have been some unsuccessful cases challenging that. So we are researching now Oklahoma law, as well as the District Court of Appeals that they're in, to see if there have been any recent decisions that might either help or hurt us. So again, that's the state of Oklahoma. So we've mentioned Michigan, yes, and Arkansas, yes, we have filed lawsuits outside the state. Also Texas, we're looking at Texas, Florida, and Oklahoma. So this is the time that I'm going to give a commercial. Folks, in order to file lawsuits, we need money. There's no other way to put it. We need funds. We need donations. And the more donations we have, the more lawsuits we can file. I love to litigate. I really do. And I'm pretty darn effective at it. I have a great track record. And it's not just the thrill of litigation, because it can also be a great burden. But the fact is that we're helping people in all these different states. And so in order to expand our horizons, in order to file more lawsuits, we really need donations. We've applied for a couple of grants in the past. We've been unsuccessful. Other nonprofits do not want to donate money to us for some reason to give us grants. On the other hand, so all of our funds come through either donation, private donations like donations from you, or we are for the lawsuit proceed. And it's just, open the kimono, as they say. When we win a lawsuit, the money goes back to the organization. It's not going to me. I want you to know. Okay. So that's how it's like a sourdough starter. So I get paid a small amount of money to file a lawsuit. Okay. Small, trust me. And then when we get the proceeds, which are almost always larger than the money that I've been paid, they go back to the organization. And that's our sourdough starter, so we can file the next lawsuit. So we also have to be careful that we don't extend ourselves too much, right? And I'm looking now at what we're expecting to happen in Missouri with the AG taking this up to the Eighth Circuit. I predict we're going to have a busy fall between now and Halloween. So, okay. And donations can be made easily. They can be made on the website. Really easy to do it. We've got a donate button right there. You can donate using a credit card or PayPal, all those methods. You can also send us a check. So I will put the Axel mailing address here too. So if you want to send us a check, that would be awesome. Zelle payments, we're really flexible. I'm learning all kinds of things. Venmo, even we can do Venmo. Okay, so that's the end of the commercial. All right, here we go. Okay, so let's talk about more lawsuits. Let's talk about two. We do have our next in-person meeting. It's in November in San Diego. So for the Californians here, or if anybody wants to take a vacation in San Diego in November, we'll be there on November 2nd in person. There's a wonderful law school down there, Cal Western Law School. They welcome us with open arms. I love them. I actually graduated from a law school in San Diego. We got a completely different, they do not welcome us there. Even though I'm an alum, they do not welcome us there. We had one meeting there, nothing bad happened. And I do mean nothing bad happened, and they won't let us come back. So Peter, your hand's up, sir. You have a question or comment, Peter?
Yes. Well, where is the meeting in San Diego in November?
It's the California Western Law School. The specific address is on our website. But okay. It's either 225 Cedar Street or 255 Cedar Street. Remembering numbers.
235.
Remembering numbers is not my forte.
Yeah.
Okay. But anyway, the information.
Yeah, it says 235. So okay. I'm assuming it's 235.
Can't tell you. It's on the website. Okay.
All right. Thank you.
You're certainly welcome. Okay. So let's talk about something I really want to talk about, and then I'll talk about other things, because this involves, I try to discuss national topics first, because I know we have people joining us today who are not from the state of California. In fact, why don't I just ask that question? How many of you are not from the state of California? You can either put your hand up like this, or if you want to raise your hand using the button on the bottom. How many people here are not from California? Okay. Yeah, quite a few. And Josiah, thank you. I see you. Yeah. And folks, again, we consider ourselves a national organization. And, I'm so encouraged by the fact that the board of directors finally gave me the green light to file lawsuits outside the state of California, because trust me, they were really nervous about it. And by the way, I'm able to do this because we can find local attorneys in other states. And so like in Missouri, there is a local public criminal defense attorney who doesn't know much about civil law, but he will, in fact, was willing to be like my sponsor, right? And so it's wonderful. And we do have criminal defense attorneys in most states now who, in fact, are willing to sponsor me as in their state. And that's what it requires. And I'm talking about we file lawsuits in federal court, and their court rules allow that to happen. So anyway, so let's talk about another big thing. It's on the horizon. I hope you know about the case Smith versus Doe, because it's caused so much harm to so many people for so long. So Smith versus Doe is a decision issued by the U.S. Supreme Court in the year 2003. And in it's 2002. So the U.S. Supreme Court in that case literally said that the requirement to register is not punished. Now, I can't imagine anybody on this call today agrees with that statement. I know I don't agree with that statement. I don't agree with an exclamation point. That's what those people, justices, decided. And we know they made a mistake, okay? And we want them to overturn their decision. And by the way, there's an interesting little factoid here. The attorney who was representing the state of Alaska in that case, his name is John Roberts. Does that name ring a bell? I hope it does, because that same John Roberts, it's kind of a common name, but it's the same person. He is now the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. Okay. This is not how he became the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. I guess it's just a coincidence, because I don't believe in conspiracy theories. However, he is the Chief Justice now. And so we need to appeal to him directly and say, hey, dude, you made a mistake. Let's give him all the respect he deserves, right? Hey, dude, you made a mistake. And so you need to clean up the mess that you've made. Okay, that's another way to put it. And we need to take it to the U.S. Supreme Court. Trust me, they take like these days, I think that it's down to 3% of the cases of the people that go to the U.S. Supreme Court and say, please, please consider my case here. Only about 3%. So the likelihood of us getting to the U.S. Supreme Court right away to get this decision overturned, small, okay? But it's not zero, all right? And there are some cases, and I can tell you about one in a few minutes, to get to the U.S. Supreme Court. But I think we have to try some moral persuasion here. We really need to make this real for the court, because they sit up there in the ivory tower. They don't know. They really literally do not know what it's like to have to register. They don't, right? And by the way, during the oral argument in that case, when the lawyers are talking to the justices, John Roberts was asked, isn't this like registration? Isn't that like applying for membership at Price Club, you know, and Costco, Sam's Club, you know, those? And he said, yes. He actually said yes. And folks, think about it. Do you think that any of these U.S. Supreme Court justices have ever been to a Price Club or Costco or Sam's Club? I don't think so, right? They have staff that takes care of that. They don't have to do this. They don't go shopping for themselves. So they have no idea. Do you think any of them have ever had to register as a sex offender? Of course not, because then they wouldn't be on the Supreme Court. You can't even have a law license if you're on the registry. So, you know, think about it. They made a really stupid decision a long time ago, and that we need to educate them. So 2 years now in a row, we have gone to the steps of the U.S. Supreme Court, and we have had a vigil. We called it a vigil. Other people might call it a protest. I really don't care what you call it. Just show up, okay? So next March of 2025, meet me at the steps of the U.S. Supreme Court. I will be there. I promise I will be there. Now, the exact anniversary date is March 5, and that is a Wednesday. So my board is thinking maybe they want to do it Thursday or Friday, make travel easier. I don't know. But Sunday in that week of March 5th, we will be there in Washington, D.C., and we invite you to come join us. We had about 50 people the first year. We had fewer people this year because we didn't spend as much time planning it, but I hope that we'll have at least 100 people or even more in 2025. This is really important, again, that we do this. Remember, one of the things I love to say, show up, stand up, and speak up. And guess what? You'll be able to do all three of those in March of next year at the steps of the Supreme Court. And by the way, there were some nervous Nellies, can I say that, the first year, and thinking that some violent acts were going to be perpetrated while we're there. Not a darn thing happened. I'm happy to report, not a darn thing happened. You know, as a lawyer, I worry about people tripping and falling. That didn't happen either. We all took very good care. Nobody fell up the steps. Nobody fell down the steps. By the way, we don't go on the steps, but we're right near the steps of the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court Police Department is there. They look at us and yawn. It's like, oh, they're back again. Okay. We have some rules about how much noise we can make, and we know what the rules are. We've done it twice now successfully. successfully, and we're going to go back the third time, again, March of 2025. Please put that on your calendar and come join us. Okay. Are there any questions about that, by the way? David, you have, is that applause, David?
Hi, Janice.
Hi.
The question I have is, does the Supreme Court ever take up cases on their own initiative?
No.
Or is a case always required?
Yeah, cases are always required. They're a reviewing court, so they can't initiate any.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. And just to let you all know, putting things in a historical context, the Supreme Court has made big mistakes in the past, and they have corrected them. So the case of Plessy versus Ferguson was basically said, oh yeah, separate but equal education, that's fine with us. Separate but equal, right? But we all know it wasn't equal. There were kids who didn't have school books, right? But oh, that's equal. That's fine. That's separate. That's equal. So, and they overturned that case, and most people know the case overturning Plessy versus Ferguson better than Plessy versus Ferguson, because the name of it is Brown versus Board of Education. So Brown versus Board of Education overturned Plessy versus Ferguson. Okay. So the court can and does sometimes correct their mistakes. Another mistake they made is Korematsu. In the Korematsu case, they said, oh, you want to take people of Japanese descent and put them in internment camps? Ah, that's fine with us. I cried. You know, it's a good thing I wasn't alive then. I don't know what I would have said. But the fact is, when I was in law school, my law school roommate of 2 years, both of her parents were in internment camp, right? And, you know, they didn't like to talk a lot about their experiences, but they talked about it a little bit. You too, Scott? Your parents, maybe? Yeah. I mean, what the hell? Were you in the camp too, Scott? Were you in a camp? No? Okay. Your parents. Yeah. So folks, you know, our Supreme Court makes some horrendous mistakes from time to time, and eventually they correct them. But you know what? I'm not that patient. We have to get Smith versus Doe overturned right away. So Panther, you have your hand up. Please go ahead.
Yes. Does that relate to, I have a question. Have you heard about the recent ruling regarding to Chevron?
I have. Thank you for bringing that up. I'm happy to discuss it since you brought it up. Okay. So there's something called the Chevron Doctrine, which is something that has been around for quite a while. And the Chevron case way back when, because that's the name of a case, basically said that executive branch officials have a lot of discretion and a lot of authority. So, I mean, what happens, folks, is the legislature, whether it's a federal legislator or a state legislator, passes a law, gets a law passed, right? And then it's up to the agencies to implement the law. So the Chevron Doctrine said that executive branch agencies have a lot of authority. So they can take what the legislature told them to do, and then they can interpret what they think that means. Quite frankly, I think that the Attorney General, the federal U.S. Attorney General, has done that for a long time when it comes to people in the registry. And I think that they've gone too far. There is a pending lawsuit called SORNA, Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act. There's pending litigation right now. And by the way, this is a case that, okay, I think this case will be helped by the recent decision that said the Chevron Doctrine went too far. Okay. That in fact, executive branch officials do not have unlimited power and authority. It's limited, okay? And they're going to make a decision based, you know, and the decision will have to be made about where the boundaries are in the authority. Now, there have been a lot of people out there wringing their hands about this and going, oh my God, this, you know, the sky is falling. I don't think so. And by the way, I worked for executive branch agencies. I saw what happened. Right. I think there are times when executive branch agencies go too far and they do things that they're not authorized to do. And I think one very blatant example is, in fact, these SORNA regulations. So we've been talking about the SORNA regulation for a while, and I don't mind talking about it once more. So here we go. Basically, these SORNA regulations, again, they were put in draft form, you know, through the Federal Register, because that's a process that needs that. It's just a process that they have to follow. Right. So they did that. And then they said that, and they were terrible. And I think it was over 700 responses to the draft regulations. We went crazy in depth with our response. We had, I'm trying to remember now, I think we had about 10 lawyers from about 10 different states weigh in on it. We did something that's kind of like a law review article with footnotes and all kinds of, you know, case citations. You know, we didn't take it lightly. We didn't say they stink and leave it at that. We told them why they stink. to the regulations, that is. So, and one reason that these SORNA regulations are so bad is because they're trying to implement a federal law that most of the states have decided to ignore. And I'm serious about this. Think about it. So the federal government had these regulations, or SORNA, the law rather, and said, hey, states, we want you to comply. We want you to comply with this law and these regulations. And only 18, and they've been trying for quite a while, only 18 states out of 50 have decided they're going to comply. And by the way, California is not a SORNA compliant state. Okay. And the federal government was using, like, you know, what do you use? You punish or the carrot or the stick, right? And so the federal government was trying to dangle this carrot above the state's heads and saying, oh, well, if only you become a SORNA compliant state, then you too will be eligible to compete for these federal grants. Well, California decided it would cost more money to comply with SORNA than they could possibly get under a grant program. So California thumbed their nose. But anyway, and so did most of the states. 32 out of 50 states thumbed their noses. Like, no, nope, we don't want any part of this. So what does this federal government do? They basically try to leapfrog over the heads of the state governments, okay? Leapfrog over the state governments and go to the individual and say, okay, even though your state is not complying with this law, we want you as an individual to comply. And let me tell you how terrible it is. And one example should make your blood run cold, okay? And so this example is that if, in fact, you are convicted of certain offenses, the federal government says you should register four times a year. Well, in California, you only register once a year unless you're a transient, then you register more. Anyway. But there are a few exceptions. But most people, I mean, over 90% of the people on the California registry only register once a year. That's it. You go in, you register, and that's over for the year, right? And it's bad enough. It's enough to have to do it once a year. But the fact is, it's just once a year. But they're saying for some of the people on the California registry, oh no, you'd have to register four times a year. So you go from zero, I mean, from one to four. Well, a couple people in California decided to test the system after the SORNA regulations were finalized and went into their registration office the second time in the same year. And the registration officer threw them out and said, what are you doing here? You're already registered for the year. I can't and I won't register you again this year. So think about it. You have a federal law that says you have to register four times a year. You have a state government that or local government that refuses to register you more than once. What do you do? And remember, what does the federal government like to do? Rattling their saber? Well, if you don't comply with our state law, then guess what? 10 years in federal prison. So these SORNA regulations are the subject of litigation. Axol is a plaintiff in the lawsuit. We are not the litigators. And I'm okay with that. I truly am. Because the organization that is litigating has so many more resources than we do, right? This is called the Pacific Legal Foundation, or PLF. They have over 50 lawyers on staff. 50. It's like a dream come true for me. 50. I have to manage all these people, supervise all these people. No, we don't have 50. And so then, and they have taken 17 cases. The Supreme Court has granted review of 17 of their cases. They have won 14 of those cases. That is really good track record. I don't know about some of your baseball players, but anyway, what that would be in a batting average or something, but I think that's a pretty high batting average. So we're absolutely delighted to be a plaintiff in the case. And this is a case that I think could go all the way up to the U.S. Supreme. So watch where it is right now, just to let you know. They did file it here in California. And so in California, the federal district court judge did grant a restraining order. Unfortunately, he went beyond that. He granted a preliminary injunction. And unfortunately, he limited two people in California. So in California, it's really clear. If you're on the California registry, you do not have to comply with the SORNA regulations. You can just skip right past them, laugh, use any finger you want to wave goodbye. You don't have to comply with them. Okay. So that's the good news. Why didn't the judge issue a nationwide injunction? I think he's afraid. I really think he's afraid. So, and can a federal district court judge grant an injunction like that? Yes, he can. Think about what happened when it came toward the end of COVID, right? And there was a federal requirement to wear masks on airplane. And there was one federal district court judge that said, no, you don't. And guess what? Nobody in the whole nation had to wear masks on the airplane anymore. So you can wear one if you want to, but you don't have to. So anyway, it is possible. So I think this judge was acting cautiously. He knows that his decision is going to be appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And if the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, no matter how they rule, then I think either party, the losing party, will go to the U.S. Supreme Court and request review. So this is a case. The Chevron doctrine applies to this because it has to do with whether or not the Attorney General had the authority to basically require anything for an individual to do when in fact the state doesn't require it or even allow it. So it's fascinating. In the meantime, by the way, if you're in a SORNA compliant state, you need to abide by the SORNA regulation. Okay. So 18 states, you need to abide by it. I'm sorry to say. But the fact is, the rest of the states, it's a question mark, except California, where you don't have to. So, and one of the issues here, by the way, is whether or not these SORNA regulations would apply to, get this, anybody who's ever been required to register. Not people who are currently required to register, but anybody who's ever been required to register, even if you're no longer required to register, which would be a terrible, terrible result. And this judge, by the way, is not, he doesn't agree with that. But that's the argument that, in fact, the federal government's making in the lawsuit. Isn't that interesting? Okay, that's SORNA. That's the Chevron Doctrine. Vicki, do you have a question or a comment? You're just waving? Okay, hi. All right, so let's talk about... I think that those are all the national issues that I was expecting to talk about today. So, again, I want to remind you of a couple of things before I go into California-centric issues. One, that our conference is September 20 and September 21. Please sign up online. Please pay attention. We're not asking you to register for the conference. I will never ask anybody to register for anything again. So we're asking you to sign up for the conference. Okay. Number two, on November 2nd, we will have an in-person meeting in San Diego. If you can make it to San Diego, that would be great. The law school is very welcoming, and we will have refreshments. And it is, of course, free as well. All right. Okay, so let's talk about some recent lawsuits that we've won here in California. I'm very happy to report the biggest one has to do with affect people who are on the registry and on parole. Okay, so if you're a registrant on parole, guess what? The CDCR Department of Corrections is no longer going to be able to keep you in treatment the entire time you're on parole. This is big news, folks. This is big news. We have almost 7,000. Thanks, Dave, for the thumbs up. We have almost 7,000 people in California who are registrants and on parole. So this decision is going to apply to every single one of them. And the thing is, what's going to have to happen now, and by the way, we have a signed settlement agreement of this case. Well, the signed settlement agreement says that CDCR must make a decision in writing every year whether or not additional treatment is required. And they've never had to do that before. And the thing is, this written decision, they have to give a copy of that written decision to the person on parole. That's never happened before either. And guess what? You have that piece of paper and it doesn't make sense. Guess what? We can take them to court. And I mean it. And we will take them to court. So for example, in the first lawsuit, there was a man, he was on parole. He was on parole and he'd been in treatment for 6 years. 6 years. He didn't have any parole violations and they kept making him repeat the same darn treatment program, right? And it was adversely affecting his employment opportunities. So finally, he said, enough is enough. And he, sure enough, we filed a lawsuit and we won because the Superior Court judge can, in fact, terminate treatment anytime after the first year that you're on parole, anytime. And that's what happened. It was beautiful to watch. The judge with the backbone, it was like watching a guillotine go down. And she said at the end of the hearing, you are no longer required to undergo treatment. The most important reason that this is very important is because the fact that you were having to undergo treatment was in fact being used against you when it came time for early discharge, being considered for early discharge. All right. So think about it. CDCR is requiring you to undergo treatment the entire time you're on parole. And then when it goes to time for you to be considered for early discharge, you're being denied early discharge because you're undergoing treatment. So I call it the tail wagging the dog. Maybe you can think of another phrase, but whatever it is, it's ridiculous. And it was illegal. And so it was great that after we filed this lawsuit, that for the first time, CDCR admitted they made a mistake and they agreed to correct it. So we have a written settlement agreement with CDCR saying that they have this new policy. Okay. Another case that we won recently had to do with attempted offenses and the assignment of tiers for people convicted of an attempted offense. So California DOJ is the state agency that is responsible for assigning people to a tier, California DOJ. Okay. And so what they said was, what they were doing rather, was they were assigning people to the same tier for an attempted offense as compared to a completed offense. Makes no sense whatsoever, right? And I call this the zipper story. So somebody basically unzips a zipper and says, I'm going to do these things to you. And the other person says, no, thank you. And they go, oh, okay, and walk away. Okay, that possibly is an attempted rape, depending what was said. But it wasn't a rape. But yet, California DOJ was putting the attempted rape person on the same tier as a completed rape, which is tier three. And that, of course, is lifetime registration. So, Blaine, you have your hand up. I don't know if it's about this case or the prior case, something else.
Yes. Hi there, Janice. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. Thank you. So I'm on parole here in California, and a couple things. I've been on this having to go to Sharper Future for 8 years now, and I'm yes, and I keep asking them now. I'm saying, hey, what about this this new change? Well, we're only going to have to go 1 year. I've already gone, you know, eight, and right. They're like, oh, well, you know, we don't know much about that. And it's like, you know what? And so I'm supposed to be speaking with somebody on Tuesday that's supposed to be providing more information on this. So do we have some kind of a document that we can print out and show them? Or, I mean, what's the best way to prove to these people and point them to this information?
Well, Blaine, if you would be so kind as to contact me, preferably by email, so I can actually send you a copy. I'll send you part of the agreement. There's two pages that are in the middle that basically say what they have to do. And I'm not surprised to hear you say, I think you're talking about the treatment provider, that the treatment provider doesn't know yet about this. However, the word is getting out to some treatment providers. And I did have somebody contact me during this past week who said that at their company, their treatment provider's company, that the treatment providers are basically resigning en masse because they realize that they are about to lose their jobs. Okay.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. So some people, the word is getting out to some people, but not all people. And you think about it, it has to get through CDCR and it has to get through the treatment providers before people understand what's going on. There will be new regulations about this. The process started in April because that's when the settlement agreement was signed. And then they have up to 6 months, no more than 6 months, to get the new regulations published. And at that point in time, you know, that takes effect. But I understand that some people, this is already happening for them, that they're already getting this evaluation done. And it might happen during a containment meeting, but the important thing is that they have to put the decision in writing, including their justification. Why should you have to continue to undergo treatment, right? And they have to give you a copy. And if they don't give you a copy of it, that's a violation right there. We can take them to court. And if they do something stupid, and like Blaine, it seems like they've already done something stupid for you, then you can take them to court.
Okay, that's good to know. One final thing. I think what the CDCR does a lot of times is they're playing a game where the people at the top know what's going on, but they don't tell the agent, or either the agents are screwing with me, because they're still, on Halloween, there's, you know, or when they talk to you, they say, you're not on any social medias, are you? And it's like, you know, I don't want to argue with them, but they're still asking for that. And then the Halloween before last, when I was paid a visit, they asked me, you know, oh, you don't have Facebook or any of that thing on your phone, do you? And and then they said, well, because we arrested somebody earlier tonight for that.
Well, here's the big picture. The government cannot prohibit you from being on social media. There's a U.S. Supreme Court decision, folks. It's not even... It's completely clear. Okay. However, the social media company may deny you. So like Facebook, if the Facebook knows you're on the registry, they will take down your page without notice, by the way. I just hope you all know that. I think it's terrible, but that's what happens. And even by the way, they will not let you on. Facebook will not let you on if you're a former registrant. So it did happen to one of our board members who is a former registrant. But anyway, but Blaine, please contact me next week. And call me after your meeting, because I really want to know what happened there. And okay, so I said I got one call last week telling me that a bunch of treatment providers are resigning, okay, because they see the handwriting on the wall. They don't think they're going to have a job. On the other hand, I got a call from a different person who said just the opposite, and their treatment provider knows about this and says, I don't care what they agreed to, I'm not doing that. So that's what we're up against. And I said to that person, tell me more information, you know, let me know if you're willing to be a plaintiff in a lawsuit, because it's ripe for litigation. Eric, you have your hand up and unmute yourself.
Yes, ma'am. Do you know the name of the U.S. Supreme Court case off the top of your head that says that sex offenders, the government cannot prohibit sex offenders from the public forums of social media?
Packingham, United States versus Packingham.
Yeah, that's right. And I wanted people to know that because I've been sharing that. I filed a 602. Mm-hmm. I got locked up in 92. There was no social media. I think MySpace was just making its appearance or something. But anyway, none of my crime had nothing to do with that. And they imposed that restriction on me. And I cited Packingham versus North Carolina in a 602, an administrative grievance to the California Department of Corrections and Rehab. Uh-huh. And they granted it. And
they granted 602.
They granted it and agreed. And I have been on social media. I am on social media. And I'm marketing myself on social media as someone who wants to, you know, use his experiences of the past 30 plus years in prison to help as many people and communities as I can.
Fabulous. Thank you.
Yeah. But the guys that are part of AXAL and the ladies, they just need to know that the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in 2017, very recently, that social media is a public forum and it violates the First Amendment rights of sex offenders to exclude them from those sites or from that access. Did I say it wrong?
You said it right, Eric. Absolutely.
Yes.
Right. Good job.
Okay.
Yeah. So Eric is absolutely correct. And I have spoken to some parole officers. I have written some letters to parole officers outside the 602 process to see if, in fact, we can get things resolved informally. And sometimes we can't. When you can't resolve it informally, that's when you file a 602. But please understand the distinction here. The government cannot prohibit you from accessing social media. Even if you, by the way, your offense involves social media, okay? They cannot prohibit you. However, the social media provider can basically deny you use of their social media site. And the biggest one, the easiest one to point out is, in fact, Facebook. Eric, did you have something else to
say? Yes, I just wanted to add, I wanted to piggyback on what you just said. Although the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that, everybody, don't take it upon yourself to go ahead and say, well, you know what? The U.S. Supreme Court said, I'm going to do it. Please, please, please talk to your parole agent. Packingham versus North Carolina. If you haven't already written it down, please write it down. Look it up. Have somebody look it up. But do the administrative grievance process. I know many people are scared of retaliation and stuff, but this is your First Amendment right and your 14th Amendment right to due process and equal protection. So I encourage and even in my treatment group, I tell guys in there, take advantage of what the law says, but do it the right way. Be pro-social about it and file your administrative redress. And it works out. I'm a living example.
Thank you, Eric. And I commend you for your courage. Okay, Chris, you have your hand up. This is Chris from Florida.
Yeah, correctly, but in Packingham, I thought the ruling to act the social media was only people that the criminal sanctions have been completed.
You know what? You were breaking up there, Chris. I'm not sure what you said.
Oh,
try again, please. Chris, I assume Chris is driving. He might have hit a rough spot there. I know about the rest of you who can't understand Chris. Sounds like he's gargling. So let's let him join us again later. Lauren, you have your hands up. Please unmute yourself.
Can you hear me, Janice?
Yes.
Hi, Janice. Good morning. I'm sorry that we're jumping back and forth between the two lawsuits, if you will. But going back to the parolee and treatment and things like that, I know we had briefly discussed it before in the regards of if that'll play any kind of part or a precedence, if you will, you know, for the federal system. Again, down in San Diego, treatment seems to be going on for 6, 7, 8 years with a, I guess, if you will, make-believe aftercare program and such along those lines.
So, Lauren, I haven't done anything yet, but I'm really interested in doing something. So why don't you contact me next week? And if you or somebody else you know is, in fact, on supervised release under the federal system, I'd be happy to sue them, too. I'm not
bashful. Yeah, I'm currently right now on supervised release in treatment, and I am now on my 6th year of treatment.
Great. You sound like somebody I need to talk to. Please call me next next week. And my contact information is available there in chat, okay?
Perfect. I have that. And I appreciate that, and I will be reaching out.
Absolutely. I mean, folks, the rules should be the same, right, whether it's state or federal. The CDCR, when it comes to parole, they were violating a state law, right? They're violating a state law that said minimum treatment of 1 year. It doesn't say what the maximum is, but it does say you're supposed to make a decision, a formal decision, about whether or not further treatment's required. And it does say, too, a Superior Court judge can end treatment whenever he or she feels like it. And that's what happened in that first case. And that's why I filed the second case. And by the way, in the first case, I thought I was going to like have to be this super lawyer and to drag out of CDCR people testifying that indeed they have this policy. But you know what? They were really open about it. They said, yeah, we have a policy. And our policy says every registrant, the entire time they're on parole, must undergo treatment. And that in and of itself was a violation of state law. Boom. I mean, it's that like courtroom drama. And by the way, when they said that, the judge got really, really upset. And she turned around and go, did I just hear you say blah, 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 blah? And they went, yeah. And she just, that's why I said the guillotine came down, and she turned to my client and said, you no longer have to undergo treatment. And that was that. He's still on parole, by the way. And he, well, I think he is. I'm not even sure. He still has to register, but he doesn't have to undergo treatment anymore. Okay, I've got a hand up. Emmy.
Yes, Janice, thank you for all your work. Have you discussed anything about travel within the United States or outside the United States?
Yes, and I'm not going to repeat it. Sorry, you'll have to listen.
I had problems trying to get in on Zoom.
All right.
Earlier, well, it took me half an hour. So, okay, I'll listen to it later. Okay.
Yeah, this meeting's being recorded, so just,
yes, I'll listen to it later. Thank you.
Right. And thank you. Okay, so, Eric's hand is up again.
Sorry, Janice. Someone messaged me asking me what happens if if your parole conditions that you sign and have to agree to say no social media. Mine did, and I did sign it, but irrespective, ignorance of the law is no excuse both ways. And once I found out that the U.S. Supreme Court protected my right to access social media, I filed an administrative grievance stating as much, and the CDCR had no choice but to agree. And for the other guy that messaged me and asked me about, didn't the Packingham case only deal with people who had already,
released from criminal sanction?
No. I read it and did not see that.
I don't agree with that statement.
I don't either. So, okay. Sorry to be a pain.
No problem. And by the way, Ellie was kind enough. She actually put the citation for the Packingham case right there. So Packingham versus North Carolina, issued in 2017, has not been overturned. All right. And I do not know why parole does this, why in some conditions they put in there no social media, when in fact they should know. I'm not saying they do know, but they should know that in fact it's not constitutional. But that's what we're dealing with. So Ray, by the way, if I disappear from time to time from the camera, I'm eating a snack here. I don't know about you all, but I'm getting hungry. Go ahead, Ray.
Thank you, Janice, for all that you do. You are a saint, essentially. So thank you so much for you and Axel. I'm really grateful. My question, you had touched on another lawsuit that you had, which affects me. And so my charge was a non-contact charge, 288-2A, I believe. And so I'm wondering, I think that a ruling has already been made for the DOJ to look at the tier reassignments. Is that, what stage is that in? Should I expect for my annual registration in August to get a new assignment letter that will have good news? Question mark. That's my question.
Oh, Ray. I'm sorry. This is when I'm going to start being sarcastic. And so my sarcasm is not aimed at you. It's aimed at California Department of Justice. They never initiate things. You have to initiate it. Okay. So, but I'm a little concerned about what you said. So we have a court order, because California DOJ wasn't going to change their policy for people convicted of an attempted offense. So only if you were convicted of an attempted offense are you possibly eligible for a tier reassignment for this situation. So, I mean, it's going to have to say Penal Code Section 664/ that other stuff. Okay. If it says 664/ the other, then yes, you're eligible. There's no process. There's no formal procedure for this. So instead, what I've been doing is writing letters to California DOJ DOJ saying this person was convicted of an attempted offense and therefore they should be reassigned to tier. It can either be two or one depending on the circumstances. So please contact me next week and I can help you wade through that. But you will need to have court document that proves that you in fact were convicted of an attempted offense. Okay. Okay. Great. Eric, you have more to add.
I do, ma'am. I'm grateful for the opportunity because I watched guys for many years in prison be so beat down by the fact of being a sex offender that they didn't understand that they're not without rights. And they just lived their lives in there, including myself when I first went in, as if they had no rights. And so even in the treatment groups I go to, when I sit and listen to guys speaking on things that are absolutely contrary to what the U.S. Constitution says for all of us, all citizens, including us, we are citizens, we're not disenfranchised, I have to speak up. And it's you said it twice already, and I want everybody to know, I want to speak for you a little bit. Part of the reason that Janice has been so successful in a lot of the litigation she's underwent is because she calls the California prison system on one basic tenet of law. I'm not going to go on a preaching thing about the delegation doctrine, but only the legislative branch has the power to make laws. The administrative agencies like the prison systems, they are required to promulgate regulations in accordance with public comment period, Administrative Procedures Act is what it's called. Janice has called the CDCR out on implementing and enforcing underground regulations. That's the legal term in the California government code. So when you guys are talking about, well, my parole agent does this or the CDCR doesn't do this, that is what the courts don't allow, is the California, any prisons, any administrative agency to implement and enforce its own laws. Regulations have to be promulgated the right way. So Janice called him out recently on the keeping people in for a policy of keeping people in for more than a year. And you heard her reaction to what the court said. Oh, hell no. So we just got to all agree that we have rights. We got to all agree that we're not subhuman, sub-citizens, disenfranchised, and not be afraid to utilize the procedures that still are part of available to us. Otherwise, we're just going to walk around being subjected to arbitrary and capricious whims.
Eric, I love everything you're saying. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sorry to beat a drum, but I feel real passionate about it. I have for many years, and I hate to see people who have rehabilitated themselves enough to be deemed suitable for parole get out and feel like they got nothing coming. So.
Eric, I'm going to say the same thing that I said to Bill, who's from COSA. I think I'd like you to be a speaker at our conference. So would you contact me next week? I really like the things that you're saying. You understand the issues quite clearly, and you're obviously very articulate. So let me talk about the Missouri case in the context that Eric's message he just delivered. In the Missouri case, our plaintiff is not Rosa Parks. Okay. And what I mean by that, Rosa Parks and what she did about sitting, you know, refusing to sit in the back of the bus, literally, was chosen by Martin Luther King and his organization because she was squeaky clean, you know, like didn't even have a traffic ticket. Okay. The plaintiff in our Missouri case is not that type of person. All right. This man, he was only convicted of one sex offense, but he has punched people in the face. He's gotten 5 DUIs. he drinks too much. He admits he drinks too much. I'm not going to call him an alcoholic, but some people might. But he drinks too much. And when he drinks, he does things, you know, he breaks the law sometimes. So I swear the attorney general's argument in that case is because he is not a good person, because he's not Rosa Parks, perhaps, that he does not have First Amendment rights. I swear that's what that case is about. Because they tried to, in his deposition, oh my God, it was painful. Painful. By the way, depositions are limited to 7 hours. We spent over 6 hours of that 7-hour deposition with the attorney general trying to shame him, trying to blame him, trying to make him feel less than human. It was awful. It was a terrible, and this is a deposition's not in front of a judge. It's with the lawyers in a room. And of course, the plaintiff was in the room. And they spent over 6 hours doing this. When it came my time to question the plaintiff, it took me 15 minutes. And I'll tell you why. Because I asked this man, I said, were you convicted of DUI 5 times? Yes. Were you convicted of assault and battery? Yes, a couple of times. You know, did all these things. And then I said, do you believe that the Constitution applies to you? He said, yes. I said, do you believe the First Amendment of the Constitution applies to you? Yes. And I said, and do you believe that you should not have to put a sign on the front door of your home on Halloween? Yes. Do you believe this is compelled speech? Yes. So what I had to say with him took less than 15 minutes. They spent over 6 hours demeaning him, trying to make him feel less than human. And the reason I'm saying this right now is I just wanted to add on to what Erica said. You have rights, even if you're required to register, even if you're required to register and on parole, you have rights. And you certainly have the right to the First Amendment, because there is no exception there, is unless you've been convicted of a sex offense or unless you know, are on parole. Nonsense. Okay. On the other hand, there are limits to the First Amendment, right? Everybody knows you can't yell and stand in the middle of a crowded theater and yell fire, right? Because that is not protected speech. But most of our speech is protected, and we're also protected from compelled speech. We do not have to repeat words that the government wants us to repeat when we don't agree with. Okay. So this is really very basic, and it's something for you to remember that you have rights. And by the way, and doing the work that I've been doing now over 12 years. And during this process, I realized that when I went to talk to legislators and their staff, I had to change what I said, how I said it, really. Same message being delivered, but how I said it. And I'm sharing this with you because I think you can use the same or similar language successfully, which is you say, I am here today to talk about how we can protect the Constitution. And then I pause. I say, by restoring the rights of people on the registry and their families. Okay. But it's that first statement that hooks their interest, where it opens their ears, that they're willing to listen to you. Because before, when I said, I am here to talk about, you know, restoring the rights of registrants, and people would slam the door, not figuratively, not literally, in my face, or they would listen to me. So sometimes it's how you say something and not what you say that makes a huge difference. So Ray, you have your hand up here. You've been so patient. Please go ahead. Great. Maybe he doesn't have anything to say. All right. So, you know, I said I wasn't going to say anything about compliance checks. I didn't do it at the beginning of the meeting, but I'm going to talk about it now, because you do have protections, not just the First Amendment, also the Fourth Amendment. So the Fourth Amendment protects you from unreasonable searches, right? And so if you're not on parole, you're not on probation, you're not on supervised release, if the cops come to your house for a, quote, compliance check to see if you actually live in that location, they can't come in your house. They cannot come inside the front door. And so, again, I'm not talking about people. You're not on parole. You're not on probation. You're not on supervised release. You do not have to let those turkeys inside of your house. And in fact, I strongly recommend you do not let them inside your house. Because if they see something that they think could be illegal, an illegal substance, I don't, it used to be rolling papers, you know, now smoking marijuana in California anyway is legal, so they can't get you for that anymore. You know, but you don't want them inside of your house, folks. You are protected by the Fourth Amendment. And so if they're there for compliance check, please step outside your front door. Close your front door. I don't even care if you're locking yourself out. You will figure out another way to get back in your house. Okay. But the fact is, you do not want those turkeys inside your house. One person who wasn't my client at the time, but later became my client, he told me that the cops showed up. He wasn't on parole. He wasn't on probation. And the police show up at his front door. And then they go, hi, are you so-and-so? Yes. That's what it should have ended. But they go, oh, well, can we come in? They ask consent. He stupidly said, yes, you can come into my house. But it gets worse. So they come in the house and they're, you know, looking here, looking there. And they go, oh, I see you have a computer over there. Can we go on your computer? Again, he stupidly said, yes. And I do mean stupidly. Okay. The cops were on his computer for 45 minutes. A long time ago, I told my children when they used to live in the same house with me, you cannot go on my computer. All right, those are my children. Now, they were doing stupid things like downloading stuff, and I didn't want it to get my computer to be infected by viruses. But the same thing with the cops. I mean, my God, what could they have done in 45 minutes? I mean, they could have put something on his computer that wasn't there before, child pornography or something else, right? No, no, no. Do not let the cops inside your house. Do not let the cops touch your computer. Again, unless you're on parole, probation, supervised release, or if they have a search warrant. Otherwise, no. And by the way, you don't even have to answer the door. Okay. If they show up, you don't have to, you know, you don't have to answer the door. Crank up your music, go take a shower, read a book, whatever you want to do, bake some cookies. The fact is you do not have to answer the door. I like baking cookies. Okay. So the fact is don't answer the freaking door, folks. You don't have to. And what happens if you don't answer the door? They will leave a card behind. They're really good at that. They'll leave a little message with hearts and flowers. Not really. But the fact is they will leave a message. They will ask you to call them. And isn't that much better anyway to talk to them on the phone than have them taunt you inside your house? They'd shake his head, yes, me too. Oh, brownies too, yeah, I like these. Okay. All right, so I've talked about blind checks. Sorry about that, but the bigger issue here is to remind you, just like what Eric said, you have constitutional rights. And sometimes you have to assert, right? Sometimes you have to assert them by yourself, or sometimes you hire a legal professional to assert them for you. Jim, your hand is up, sir.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
If a officer comes to your house for a normal compliance check and you're not at home, do they have the right to go to one of your neighbors and ask them about you?
That's the stickier wicket, Jim. They probably do, unfortunately. But they shouldn't be asking any difficult questions, shall I say, but they might tell your neighbors that you're on the street. Yeah. And that's why sometimes if law enforcement comes to your front door, you might want to answer the front door, because sometimes the clowns show up in like SWAT gear, right? And you never know. You don't want the neighbors to wonder what the hell is going on over there. Is this a meth den or what's going on, right? So you might just want to answer the door to get rid of them. But when you do, if you make that choice, I'd say name, rank, and serial number. Is your name Janice? Yes, it is. Do you live at this address? Yes, I do. You know, where you can.
I have been at the doctor's office and we have a Nest, and I have talked to the officer over the Nest, and they seem to be satisfied with that.
Are you saying Nest, N-E-S-T?
Yes, it's a doorbell.
Oh, okay. Or ring doorbell or something like
that. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I mean, that's what's supposed to be happening, is they're supposed to determine whether or not you actually live there. I guess there's some pretty creative people out there, and sometimes people give some interesting addresses like a public library or Walmart or something like that. So that's what the compliance check is supposed to be about. Okay. All right. You're certainly welcome. So let's talk about the tiered registry law in California. Ellie, are you still with us? I don't see your name here.
Yes, I am.
Oh, there you are. Still here. Okay. Well, do you want to give a brief overview of the tiered registry law?
Sure. So I'm sure most of you who live in California are familiar with the tiered registry law. There are three different levels. There's tier one, tier two, and tier three. And tier one requires registration for 10 years. Tier two requires registration for 20 years. And tier three requires registration for lifetime. Sometimes there are exceptions made when something doesn't fall into tier three, but based upon the Serasso score, somebody is placed into tier three. For example, I have a client with two misdemeanor offenses, both of which are 10 years for registration, and somehow he got placed into tier three. And I'm trying to work on that in order to see who determined that he's in tier three. And I'm just running into roadblocks with the Department of Justice. But Janice, I think on previous occasions, talked about terminating registration. And there is a petition online. She suggests just completing the petition and then submitting it to the court and the prosecutor, and then submitting supporting documents, perhaps completion of therapy, to the prosecutor to determine whether or not the termination should be granted. One thing that individuals need is from the police department where the individual registers, and it is, the document is called
called proof of current registration. And that is necessary, that it also requires the individual to go to the police station and obtain that document. And I do this work in Los Angeles where I work, and my services are free. It's harder to do it outside of LA County only because it involves court hearings usually. But what also is required is that when the petition is served, and served is a legal term meaning that the prosecution was given a copy, because the judge is not allowed to get documents without first notifying the prosecutor. But the petition also has to be served to the police department where the individual registers, and also to the police department where the arrest occurred if it is a different location, if it's a different police department. And the tier three, which is the lifetime, I believe there's an off-ramp for somebody who was placed into tier three, perhaps by a judge, or perhaps like my client who has two misdemeanors, and somehow he was placed into tier three. But the petition itself is a couple of pages. And like I said, the document that is proof of current registration is necessary. I also add the yearly registration form that the individual can get from the police department. And once it's, you know, served, then the prosecution starts its procedure. And with case law, and thanks to Janice for some of this, the case law now requires that the prosecution has the burden of proof to show that the person's registration should not terminate. And I've done, I think, three different petitions. I'm not as, I don't have the track record like Janice, but for all three, I did not have to go to court. And the prosecution is pretty good about emailing me in regard to, you know, the case. And so it's, I think with the way the case law is, I think the prosecution has now realized that the barriers they were putting up are no longer allowed to be barriers in court. So the process is getting easier. Myself and a couple of other board members are going to be doing a presentation about the tier registry at our September conference. And we'll go into more detail, especially in regard to the case law that's out there, because fortunately for someone like Janice, if the trial court denies her petition for no good reason, she takes it up to the appellate court, and the appellate court then gives us some interpretation of the law that will help us in the future.
Yeah, thank you very much, Ellie, for that description. I wanted to share some statistics too, to let you know that quite a few petitions have been granted. I don't think enough, but it's not for it. But the reason is I don't think enough people are actually filing petitions, but here it goes. So far, 6,927 petitions have been granted. That means almost 7,000 people are no longer required to register in the state of California. 126 petitions have been denied. Now, denied is not the same as, I'm sorry, denied means on the merits, for some reason was denied. And then 518 petitions have been dismissed. And a petition being dismissed is usually because the person wasn't eligible yet, okay? So, and there's 1,411 petitions that are now pending. So this is good progress. Again, any number of people not required to register is fabulous. And as I said, I have had 105 petitions granted so far, and I'm working on even more. My initial goal was 100, but when I reached the goal of 100, I said, oops, need to revise my goal. So now it's 200. I don't know, maybe it'll be 1,000 before it's over. But the fact is, I feel so proud every single time and so happy for the person who's no longer required to register in the state of California. And so that's why I'm, you know, in the courts battling this out. But let me tell you too, when a petition is filed, these days, only about 10% of the petitions are objected to by a DA, a district attorney. If the DA does not object to your petition, so for 90% of the people, guess what? There's no hearing. The judge must, in fact, grant your petition. So it turns out to be a matter of paperwork. So I think those are pretty good odds. 90% chance of something happening is damn good. And then it gets even better, because what Ellie was just talking about in generalities are some appellate court decisions out there that basically shifted the burden of proof. And this is fabulous, because it used to be that the judges were saying, or I'm sorry, the DAs were arguing that in fact you would have to prove that you do not pose a current risk. Oh my goodness, that's really hard to prove a negative. Whereas now, because of these appellate court decisions, the DA must prove that you do pose a current risk, or the DA is going to lose. Right? Bob, you have your hand up.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to reiterate that if anyone out there is hesitating or nervous about petitioning for the requirement to register to be terminated, I was incredibly afraid of the process, because I had to take on a residence in California when I've lived in Arizona for 20 years. Granted, it was expensive, but I was nervous about compliance checks, and I wasn't going to be there all the time because I lived in Arizona as well. By the way, I'm number 96 on Janice's roster.
Yes, you are.
Very proud of that, and incredibly thankful to Janice for making it happen. But it went incredibly smoothly. It took about 4.5 months, but there was no opposition from the DA. I was incredibly worried, as I mentioned, about compliance checks. There was never a compliance check and never a note left, like when I wasn't there. And, you know, I know it hasn't gone as smoothly for everyone, but I did want people to know that mine was more recent. My petition was pretty recent, and it went absolutely smoothly.
Yeah, well, Bob, it's indeed a pleasure to cut those chains from you, and you're no longer required to register.
Now I'm coming home.
Yeah, that's even better. Thank you. All right, Peter, you've got your hand up.
Yes, I want to thank you also, Janice, for all that you do for us. And I just wanted to share a little bit what's happened to me recently. I got my parole moved to from Imperial County. Now I'm in San Diego, and this is because now I have to be 35 miles away from my victim, and because of my violation that I got, it was failing to register with Miramar College. And I was taking some self-advocacy courses online on Zoom. And what happened was my parole agent found out about that, and she arrested me for that. And I did a 10-day flash in the county jail, got out. And then 2 weeks later, after I got out, she petitioned for my parole to be moved to San Diego here. And it's in Escondido. So I'm in Santee, in a sober living home in Santee. And right now, what my dad's trying to do is he's trying to fight for me. And we got a good attorney. And I had spoken to Ellie in the past, but I stopped because I'm hoping for the best for this attorney to help us. We put out a habeas corpus, and I was filing so many 602s to Sacramento on the parole agent that I had in Imperial County. And it's just ridiculous the way they've been treating me. And I'm a San Diego Regional Center client too. And she had no morals or empathy for me, you know, whatsoever. She would just, you know, make me stutter and get me all nervous and anxious. And like, she has no heart whatsoever.
No empathy, for sure. Okay.
Yeah.
Peter,
yeah.
I'm sorry that you're facing those challenges before you. And unfortunately, the law does say you're supposed to register with the campus, even if you're completing a class online. But how in the heck are you supposed to know that?
Yeah. And I didn't even know that because I had no intention. I thought it just applied if you go on the campus, you know, because it makes sense if you're on the campus, but if you're online, you know, I don't know, but see, I did do it. I went through the process already, but for that consequence, I'm in San Diego, but I'm making the best of San Diego right now. I mean, I got out of the heat. That's the
well, lucky you, because I'm in the heat here in Sacramento. All right. Yeah. So Peter, if you don't mind, we're going to go back to the tiered registry law and petitioning process here. You know, we do have some interesting deputy DAs out there. When they object to the petitions, right, they come up with some really crazy, crazy reasons why to do it. I had one, it's over a year ago now, maybe even 2 years, but it was a deputy DA in Los Angeles County. My client, a woman, I mean, there aren't that many women on the registry, right? And she'd been registering successfully for 30 plus years. She had a clean criminal record before, and she had a clean record after, right? And they objected to her petition. And I called the deputy DA. I said, why are you doing this? And literally he said, because we can. So you know what? I took that as an opportunity to educate that young attorney as to, no, you actually can't do that. And here are the reasons why. And guess what? I was successful. And so that petition was granted. And also, only in one of my cases, and I have filed now over 140 case petitions, and only one of them did the judge act stupidly. And trust me, I was so upset that day. Not as upset as my client, I have to admit. But the fact is that the minute we walked out of that courtroom, I told my client, don't worry, we're going to appeal this decision of this judge. We appealed, and the appellate court agreed with us that, in fact, the DA had made a mistake. And I'm sorry, in this case, the judge had made a mistake. And by the way, the judge was a former deputy DA. A lot of judges are. And so they think like deputy DAs. That day, the judge, I swear, he forgot that he was wearing a robe and that he was supposed to be independent and he was supposed to be, you know, not biased. And he said some terrible things that day. But guess what? We got the last laugh because he, in fact, had to sign an order granting that petition. That was a good day. Okay, so I want to wrap things up here. I know I've kept you a little bit later than usual. We should get things done in 2 hours, but we obviously had a lot of important things to talk about today. I just want to remind you of opportunities here in the near future. We've got the conference in September. We have a meeting in person in San Diego and November. And of course, we have these monthly meetings every single month. I haven't looked at the date for next month. I apologize. But it's usually the third Saturday of the month where we have these Zoom meetings, right? And then we also have emotional support group meetings at least one a week throughout the state of California. And most of the emotional support group meetings, guess what? You can, in fact, join meetings just this way and remotely. So thank you all. Please stay safe. Stay out of custody, please. And if you can, make a donation to the organization. You need to do so. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.